Sermon this morning will be taken from Psalms, the 15th Psalm. Psalm 1:5. We'll get there. And hey, it might even look like a short sermon. This is a Psalm of David, and I say that with assurance only because nobody discounts it as being a Psalm of David. The internal parts about it, you know, seem to be the kind of language he uses in the things he's interested in. But it's an interesting, you know, if it is from David, then it probably looks like a period of time when he has, you know, rescued the Ark of the Covenant and now is trying to make a permanent place of worship for the people of Israel. And one of the things that he knows about, you know, having permanency in worship is that it has a tendency to become ritualistic. And so the psalm seems to be dealing with, you know, what is really the bottom line as to who is a true worshiper. You know, what needs to be done. Now, this gets away from all the ceremonial stuff and everything else. This is what, you know, you bring into it. And the easiest way, you know, he goes about doing that to make this other than just a dissertation on what, you know, a true worshiper is it starts, you know, in a very interesting way. It goes, "Oh Lord," you know, he's asking God, you know, who is it who can abide in your tent, or who can, you know, dwell, you know, on your holy hill? Now, to kind of discount one thing, you know, even as eventually there'll be a temple built around, you know, the Ark of the Covenant and stuff like that, we're still looking at Zion here, you know, the Mount of the Lord, where permanent worship was going to be considered, where God said, "This is, you know, the place I want to be worshipped." Now, nobody really goes in there to kind of camp out. You know, even when, you know, the temple was built, only the priest was allowed to go into the holy place once a year. So we're really not talking about, you know, who can, you know, basically, you know, lay down or set up shop or, you know, build a house there. We're looking at, you know, coming into the presence of the Lord. And so as David is asking this, this is the way we have to look at it. This is God's answer. These are the people who really, you know, are acceptable to me. You know, as in fact, as, if we're looking at an Oriental custom here, as God is the host, for those that come in, he would accept and invite in to his dwelling, you know, or in his to presence. And with that comes the obligation of protection and sustenance. So who is God going to protect? Who is God going to nourish and feed, whatever? So in this way, very short psalm, David gets to the heart of it. And he does it, you know, with, now it's not going to be exhaustive, but he's going to give us, you know, a really good idea. And we'll try to make some analogies to this. Okay, first of all, he goes, "He who walks in integrity." Integrity, some translations, blamelessness, holiness, whatever. This is an individual that in every aspect of his life, if you view him as a farmer, metaphorically, and he has several fields, whatever, every field of his life is cultivated to be moral, to be dedicated to God. That's what integrity is. The idea, the concept, you know, from the Old Testament into the New, you shall love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your might, every compartment of your life. It could be finances, it could be friends, it could be worship, it could be business, whatever. All those fields in your life are dedicated to service to God. Okay, that's who God's looking for, someone who's well-rounded. Yeah. Now, that individual also is someone who does no evil to his neighbor. Now, get the end part of this. The way this thing is structurally broken down, in verse 2, you have three participles, which, you know, as the use of the participle is, it means this is something that's durative. You know, this is something you never do wrong to a neighbor. You never do evil. Okay, you never take up a reproach against a friend. This is your character. This is your very nature. This is who God is looking for. He's not looking for an outward sham. And this is what, you know, David is trying to argue against. As we set up, you know, worship to God, to get away from it being ritualistic and just superficial. Okay, we'll use some examples here. Okay, we just got through taking the Lord's Supper. Was it ritual for you, or was it deeply embedded? I mean, think about it. And then we bowed our head, you know, we took the bread, we took the fruit of the vine, you know, we took it. Is that the depth of our worship? Or were you actually thinking about, you know, what's going on here? You know, and you're committing yourself here in so many ways. I was thinking about this. This thing's actually laid out like a coffin. What you're looking at is a death. This is a memorial, as if you went to a funeral. I mean, it's evident. You know, you have, here's the body, here's the scriptures, and here's the blood, and the life is in the blood, and the blood is separated from the body. You got a dead person right here. And when you partake of the Lord's Supper, you're showing his death until he comes. And it's a proclamation of it. But there's a hope for the future too. Okay, as we take of this, are you thinking about, you know, I'm breaking this bread with everybody that's here. God is impartial. He doesn't care, you know, what color you are. You know, he doesn't care, you know, what status in life you are. Christ died for all of us. So in 1 Corinthians 10, it goes, by the one bread, we are the one body. So by us taking it, we're sitting down as in the meal, 1 Corinthians 6, where he talks about if someone's a sinner, you don't eat with them. Where we're looking at each other as acceptable, each one of us is acceptable to God, of equal status. And therefore, we're taking the Lord's Supper for that. Okay, to show that. Okay, when we take of this, in some places, when it talks about the fruit of the vine, where it's likened to the blood of our Lord shed. But in two places, it's also called the blood of the covenant. So as you're partaking of this, okay, are you thinking about the covenant you made with God? And that's going to come up in the psalm, the covenant you make. So did you think about the covenant? That this week, I mean, we do this every week, the first of every week, to help us through the week. You know, are you rethinking that covenant and your commitment to God? And in you, as you partake of the body and put the life back into it, then we become the church, his body. Now, a resurrection of his life in us. And that's just a part of it. I mean, there's so much the scriptures give us to think about as we go through these things. It's not a ritual. It's something to help us, you know, start looking on the inside and welling up a different kind of character and commitment. And this is what it's gauged for. When people come and say, oh, what's going on there? Not much. Well, it's because you didn't bring what you should have brought. Yourself, your integrity. So what God is looking for is someone with a strength of character. You know, that even as you do something here, it is so ingrained that you take it outside. So even with a neighbor, you know, you never do anything wrong against it. No evil comes out of you against anyone around you. Nor do you take up a report, any kind of little slight. Do you take it up against a friend? I mean, this is one of those things, you know, why does it mention a friend? Because friends are the people you know the most about. You know, sometimes they're deep, dark little secrets, you know, because they're friends that have confided in you. They've looked for help in you. And you've got something on them. Someone with a deep character never lets that secret come out. It's never used against a friend. Now, as it starts verse 3, there's a change in structure. And it goes into like finite verbs and perfect tenses. That means what follows is habitual. You know, it's set ingrained in your character. And it's all put in the negative, but anytime you look at a negative in the scriptures, you're also, if you don't do this, what is it implied? Well, you need to do the positive. I mean, if you took from the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not murder, is that it? I'm cool because I just don't go around killing people. No, it expects the opposite, that you go down and try to give life to people anywhere you can. So as verse 3 proceeds, no slander is found on his tongue. We're getting deep in these things. In fact, is there something that I missed yet? Walks in integrity, walks in righteousness. In fact, I got some verses mixed up here. Walking in righteousness. Does righteousness. Notice it doesn't say he does right. Because in the Hebrew, in why they translate it righteousness, is because righteous has a fuller, full-bodied meaning to it. Yeah. Not just the right thing, but the whole aura of your character is right with God. Yeah. You're looking to do the right thing, not omitting anything. It talks about walking in... this is a simple thing. I'm butchering it all over the place. Speaks the truth in his heart. Now, I can sit up here and talk truth, but is it coming from the heart? When you talk truth, is it coming from the heart? Well, let's use it in our rituals. We just got through singing a song. Okay? When you sit there and sing the song, is it a ritual or is it from the heart? I mean, you're looking at, I love the tune. Yeah, just get, whatever. Now, I kind of require fast tunes from the song leaders before I get up here immediately because I don't want, putting you to sleep before I even get up here to put you to sleep. Are you looking just at the meter? Or are you trying to be precise and looking at the notes? Just trying to get that note right, whatever. Or are you singing, with the understanding, with the proper attitude? When you talk about, the things that God has given us, standing up for what's right, all the things you go through, is it from the heart? When you talk about, defending God to the very last, do you really mean it? I know sometimes the singer makes us stand up and we have a stand-up song like Stand Up for Jesus, but are you really prepared to stand up for Jesus? Okay. A difference between a ritual and really bringing God your full character. So I guess we've already covered verse 3. Doesn't slander with his tongue, does no evil, doesn't report. Now get down to verse 4. In whose eyes... a reprobate is despised. Actually goes along with the next verse too, or the next clause, where it says, but honors those that fear the Lord. So you get a choice, that you're making here. Most of the things you're going to run into in this life, especially the error that's taught in the church, and I know where I speak because I've been guilty of it. When I first started preaching, you have people come to you with your problems, and you try to present things in such a way that you try to soothe their pain. You try to, let me give you an example. If somebody's in an adulterous situation, and they're going to give you the emotional thing, my former, like one guy told me, my former wife was really a pain, she was... it was impossible to live with her. But my new marriage, we've got a very loving wife, a good relationship. We've got kids from it, whatever. Okay, now what they're doing all the time, and preachers have a tendency to sympathize. We understand your pain. We understand the problems that you're going through. But we're trying to argue the case from the human standpoint. And what we should be doing is arguing from God's standpoint. What does God allow? Who does he allow to dwell in his holy hill? I mean, I can, you know, we can placate you all you want to and sympathize and stroke you and whatever. But what comes down to it is what David is covering. Who will God accept? I mean, if in Malachi, you know, he says, I hate divorce, guess where you are? If you've had a divorce, that's not scriptural. Or the big thing we're going to be, you know, covering on homosexuality. Or whatever. You know, we can argue the case for the individual, their rights and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, I feel for, you know, homosexuals, the gays. If, you know, people are, they're going through persecution. But, you know, some of it they bring on themselves, you know, some of their, you know, the consequences of their act and the health, okay, they're not, I don't want to victimize them. Okay, they're souls that are precious. They need to see God's perspective if eventually, on Judgment Day, they want to be found right with God. And this is where, as a Christian, we have to take a stand. If we have individuals that just don't want to get it, this is why he uses the word reprobate. There are people that you cannot change. There are people that have taken a stand against God in their error. They sympathize with humanity. They sympathize with their own self. And you just cannot stand with them because they stand opposed to God. And you've got to make that choice. And this is who God is looking for. Someone who's standing with Him. In fact, who actually honors those who fear God. I mean, the big problem with the world is it does not fear God. And so when we find somebody and they're going to be, you know, small numbers of people that actually, you know, want to respect God and do what He says no matter what, we better be there for them to help them because they need all the help they can get. And that's who God's looking for. Yeah. You've got to have, back in the Old Testament we talked about, if some of the things that God, you know, said was capital punishment, if you found somebody engaged in adultery, okay, you are a witness. That means God expected you to have the backbone to sit there and give testimony in trial, and as part of the witness, be one of those to cast the stones that's going to execute them. I mean, can you do that? I mean, nowadays people have lost that backbone. I mean, they'll kill unborn babies, but they don't want to hurt serial killers. So they'll spend time in prison. You know, we've got people in prison in California, you know, under a death penalty. And California, as far as I know, still has the death penalty. You know, okay. But they're not executed. I mean, the people on death row have a better chance of living to a ripe old age than I do. And now as the prison system's getting more crowded, you know, we're letting real, you know, felons out. Okay. There's no feel for justice here. Whereas God expects us to do the right thing. You don't have to be happy about it, but you have to have the intestinal fortitude in order to carry out God's will against all odds. Got to do the right thing. This is what God is looking for. Notice as he goes on, he goes, here's an individual that swears to his own hurt and does not change. Now, there's a lot of, you know, kind of vows and contracts. I mean, there's a lot of things this can plug into. In business, did you ever sit down and sign a contract? What does that contract mean? I mean, there was a time in the Old West when you shook hands, and that was the deal. Because, why? Your word was good. Your word was good. When it wasn't good anymore, they had to sign contracts. Okay. Now that we're signing contracts, now we also have lawyers to get us out of the contracts. Okay, it gets a little dicey. But, yeah, I mean, they can argue, well, the good of the shareholders and all this kind of stuff, but you made a deal with somebody. And just because circumstances changed. I mean, one of the things I read about Donald Trump was that, you know, one person, one of the few people he really respected was Tiffany. Because if that guy made a deal, it doesn't matter, you know, if the consequences went south, he kept his word. He said, I always do business with Tiffany. Or, was it Toyota one time and said, we want to sell you your next car and your integrity has consequences. You may be able to rip somebody off the first time, but you can't constantly make a living of that. You're going to be found out. Even, you know, the biggest, you know, companies out there, when people start dealing poorly, you know, they get caught. Okay? But, you know, what God is looking for is someone that, you know, and we can get more personal here. Okay, most of you are married. You took a vow, you know, to love, honor, cherish, till death do us part, sickness and health, better or worse. Okay, when that goes south, what are you going to do? Now, hopefully, you know, it's going to be happy ever after, you know, with all this kind of stuff. but, yeah, you made, you know, you gave your word. You made a vow before God. So what happens if, you know, the spouse starts getting senile or gets in an accident and gets horribly mutilated or becomes sick and, you know, can barely... What good is your word? You said you'd stick with them no matter what. Was it worth anything? We're talking about your core integrity, your moral character. This is why God hates divorce, not only because of the consequences, but now he's looking at somebody he can't trust. Which brings us to another vow. What about your conversion to God? You said, I'm going to serve you the rest of my life into eternity. But when the pressure comes on, are you going to melt under that? Or are you going to stand with him? I mean, this is just common sense. Who can you trust? When problems start happening, who can you keep your back to? Who's going to be there for you? That's what God's looking for. That's what we need to find in each other. These are the kind of people that can approach God. And just in, you know, as it displays itself in our everyday living, you know, verse 4. It does not lend with interest. As we are feeling like Israel, we consider each other brothers. But this carried over even to the foreigner among them. You know, how are you going to behave yourself toward them? Are you going to try to take advantage of their poverty? Okay, they fall on hard times. And so you're going to be the loan shark? Yeah, I'll loan you some money to get you through, but I'm going to charge, you know, 50%. You know, you're gearing this to keep them in debt and in poverty. This is not the kind of spirit that God is looking for. We talked about, you know, the negatives and the positives. What God is looking for is someone who's there to help his neighbor, to help his brother, to be there for them. Yeah, think of... rural America, when somebody's barn burns down, all the neighbors show up to help, you know, raise another barn. You know, the guy doesn't get the bill in the morning. They're there to help each other. Okay, they consider themselves a family, good neighbors, you know, doing what's necessary in order to not only make the relationship better in the community or whatever, but making sure people have a good idea of what God's like. Because that's what you're trying to show them. You know, God sends the rain on the just and the unjust. You know, he cares for all. You know, he wants the best for everyone. And he works toward that, even to the extent of, you know, sacrificing his son for us. So if we're supposed to be in his image, okay, how are we conducting ourselves, especially if this person, our neighbor, is also in God's image? And you're taking, you know, taking advantage of him. Even slander, I mean, it talks about, you know, earlier the tongue. Think of James, the 3rd chapter, verses 8 through 10, where it talks about what comes out of the mouth. You know, we're looking at the source of this. You know, what comes out of the mouth, you know, is like a fountain. It can't give bitter water and good water. It's going to be one or the other. One or the other. And God's looking for a heart that gives forth what is good. And also, the last thing he talks about is, you know, someone who doesn't take a bribe against the innocent. We may not think of it that much in this country, but our laws have been fighting against it for a long time. If you want to build something, pretty much, you better be prepared to grease the skids. Contractors know, that they have to do favors, something for, the people in power. And it's getting worse and worse. But it's still not as bad as it is in most countries. Ralph Peters, who really does research on this kind of stuff. In fact, he's also a military expert. W.B. Griffin called him probably the best strategist alive when it comes to military theory. But he's also into seeing what works economically and stuff. And his comments in one of the books I read on him has to do with the bribery and how economics works. When you got a country that floats on bribery, it'll never economically take off. Never. Because you can't do good business. Okay? And you have to keep a low key. Only when everything is up and above board can a nation be strong and a people be strong. If they're trying to undercut and you can't get anything done, if you're going by, this is the law, but you understand that it doesn't matter what the law says. It doesn't matter if you carry out, pay proper taxes, get the proper permits and stuff, if you're still going to have to pay something else. And you don't know where it's going to stop. What God mostly tells us not to do is something that, in the long run, will basically kill a nation. So he wants to get it at the very source. Don't take bribes. It's a form of coercion, of extortion. And if you're going to stand for God, you don't permit it. And it's going to cost you. If it doesn't cost you in the bribe, it's going to cost you in the flack. Or the things you won't be able to accomplish just because you didn't go along with the business practices or the illegal practices of the time. So these are things that really test a person's character. It's not all of it, but these are the big things. And a lot of these things are condemned in the Old Testament Mosaic Law anyway. But there's reasons for them. God is looking for those who are exemplary. And then, David closes this thing with, he goes, he who practices these things will never be shaken. Now, this concerns godliness. This is your relationship with God. When you have this as your permanent character, it's ingrained, it's habitual, it comes from the heart. God's going to allow you to stand with Him. In fact, it goes, it doesn't matter what comes along. This is what David says, and the implication of either persecution or temptation, you'll remain tight in your godliness. Which is really should be your deepest concern, because you lose that and you lose the invitation to dwell with God. These are very serious things, and things that the Christian needs to consider, especially as we deal with one another, and then as we go out in the world and practice it. If there's anything we can do to help you with this, any kind of classes or prayers or whatever, please let us know, because this is the heart of it, the heart of your worship to God. The invitation is extended. Won't you come as we stand to sing?